Our speaker today is Jim Ansley. Jim is Division Sales Manager with Guaranty Trust Mortgage, a subsidiary of Volunteer State Bank. Jim provides strategic leadership for 8 account executives in the eastern half of the country. His team generates over $100 million in residential loan production per month from 25 states. In his 30-plus years in the mortgage banking field, he has had executive sales-level positions for national lending platforms with financial companies such as Fireman Fund, Pittsburgh National Bank, Regions Bank, and Fifth Third Bank, resulting in $40 billion in loan production. He's a past member of North Georgia Children's Center, a published author, and a 6-gallon blood donor. Jim holds a BS degree in business administration with a finance major from Ohio State University, and he has completed MBA courses at Wright State University and Eastern Michigan University. Jim and his wife Tammy have lived in Polo since 1998 and have lived in Ohio, Georgia, and Whitmore Lake, Michigan before that, and are members of Coming First United Methodist Church. I got to know Jim through Jeff Meyer, who is the manager of Provino's here and who's attended the luncheon. And Jeff and Jim are friends from way back and reconnected. And so Jim spoke at the Norcross luncheon too, and I asked him if he would also speak at the Polo Men's Breakfast. So here he is, and great to have him speak. Welcome, Jim Hensley.
All right, let's have a word of prayer. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and redeemer. Amen. Before I get started, I'd like to recognize these two gentlemen down here, my Emmaus brothers, Rick and Blake, for coming up to support me. I really appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot. And Hines, you read that bio well, and I appreciate you, again, asking me to speak. And as Hines said in my bio, that I am a published author. And I would like to share with you my first and only work. I wrote a devotional in the upper room, and it was dated Wednesday, October 24th, 2011, and the title of it is A Quiet Witness. Since I was a small boy, my mother has read the upper room each day. Occasionally, I read it also. One witness I can remember from my childhood was about Frank Ryan, quarterback of the Cleveland Browns football team in the early 60s. The Browns were my favorite professional team, and Frank Ryan's willingness to witness to his faith left a lasting impression on me. When I left home to attend college, my mother faithfully sent me the upper room every 2 months. After I graduated, she continued to send it over the next 10 years as I went through several job relocations. During those years, I got into a habit of reading the meditations daily, even though my mother never preached to me about it. She never knew whether I read those magazines or not. Now I'm a member of a church that supplies the upper room, and my mother no longer has to mail them to me. But I realize how important her example and persistence were in building a discipline of Bible study and prayer in my life. I want to be that same example for my children and for people I meet. I wrote this as a tribute to my mother, who for the first 30 years of my life was the primary Christian role model for me. As Hines said, and you've figured out, I'm from Ohio, and a couple of native Georgians I've talked to, my childhood was probably not much different than growing up here in Forsyth County, I would guess. Rural country, farming community, and my three brothers and I, we football, basketball, baseball, that was the cycle. And other than that, that was pretty much it. Now, the difference is where I grew up in Ohio, it hasn't changed that much. Forsyth County, if you grew up here, and Blake being a native around here, it's a whole different thing, but I can go home and it hasn't changed that much, and it's good and bad about that, but it was a good life. My mother was the spiritual leader of my household, nothing wrong with my father or anything, but that was just the role. We had a really nice childhood. My three brothers, none of them got a college degree. I was the first one to get a college education in my family. Went to work at two of them were railroaders. One of them was went to work for BP in their factory. Again, good careers for them. I graduated in 1980 from Ohio State. I put myself through college. I worked the whole time, and my parents really couldn't afford that, but it worked out great. And I started my first job in mortgage banking right out of school, and I've been in that industry ever since. 1983, I made a few promotions, and I got transferred down here to Atlanta to open up the South for PNC Bank. Moved into the Sandy Springs, Roswell area, an apartment, and had an office down on 85 at Century Center. Different kind of lifestyle for a young single guy in Atlanta is pretty good move for me, certainly. But my wife, I had met her at my first job in Springfield, Ohio, so we kept a relationship. And next thing, I took another job in 85 with Fireman's Fund. So I had a mortgage division. I had a chance to open my own office, and I did it on Northridge exit. That was the only offices, that was the farthest north of any office building I could find. There wasn't anything, as we've talked about, past Northridge from that standpoint. There was a little bit on Holcomb Bridge, but not a whole lot in 85. So I had an office there, and I bought a home on Lake Lanier, right around the corner from Baldridge Marina, a little bachelor pad. And it worked out great. For a year and a half, and then I decided to get married in 87. That was a pretty big year for me. In 1987, three things happened. I was married, I joined Coming First United Methodist Church, and I joined Polo in 87. I know, JR, you said 88. I got you beat by 1 year. One of the reasons I, of course, joined Coming First United Methodist Church as my wife and I decided to take our wedding vows seriously, and we wanted to find a church. And we've talked about Coming at the time had a chapel at Baldridge Marina, which was right around the corner. And we said, that's pretty neat to have a little chapel right close to us that we could go to church. So we joined that, I hadn't been much of a Christian before that, other than reading the Upper Room that my mom sent me. So my wife and I said, let's give this a shot. We joined Polo because Chatham, the developer that developed Polo, had another community in Brookfield, in the name of Brookfield West. And you remember there too. So with my office there in Northridge, I was able to play golf and entertain customers at Brookfield West, and at the time, Brookfield West had a LPGA event there every year, so it was a nice course. So that worked out good for me business wise. A little bit about Polo, it had some challenges in '87 when it opened up. First off, but because of Brookfield, it didn't matter to us. But we knew we wanted to, as a couple. My wife didn't want to stay in that bachelor pad in Lake Lanier forever, and she wanted to get into a community and start a family. So there wasn't anything else in Forsyth County. I mean, there was no subdivisions in 87, but they built nine holes is all they had. You went out number one here and went out the first five holes. Number six was nine coming back, and seven was 10. And 17 and 18 was 8 and 9. So you played nine holes the first when we joined. And you're talking about wet. It was definitely wet back then. And it was hard to even have a decent lie in a fairway. The other thing about socializing at Polo, it was a little tough because Forsyth was a dry county. there was no alcohol. And not that you have to have alcohol to have a good time, but it kind of helps to, you know, have a little glass of wine or something when you're, the rule was you brought your own. You can to bring your own alcohol to, you know, out on the course or to have dinner, and I never did. There was another bar here, I don't remember. There was two bars. Why we had two bars when we couldn't even serve alcohol, I have no idea, but guys would bring their, did you do this, JR? You bring your handle and write your name on it, and you could put it behind the bar, and that was how you'd have a drink here when we first go. So that was, so socializing was a challenge. The other thing was tennis. The courts were right here where the practice area was. There was no other tennis area or pool. It was just this pool. And there was no way to play. There wasn't that many in the subdivision, but, you know, Alta has a certain geographic stipulation. They won't go in the, you know, too far, I mean, to play. And they would not go to Forsyth County when we first joined. So you could not play Alta here. So there was no... you couldn't play. There was great to have tennis courts, but there wasn't anybody to play because Alta would not go to Forsyth County in 87. So that was a challenge. And of course, there was only one street, Polo Drive, and then this street coming here. And, you know, and of course, gradually they built sections, but it was pretty sparse in the name and the houses as well. So the big drawing thing was polo, right? I mean, they had polo matches here, and then one other event. Did anybody ever go to the steeplechase that was here? Yeah, that was right outside Bethelview. They had the steeplechase. All the hoity-toity people from Atlanta would come up and mingle with us once a year. And go ahead.
Presented that because they kept throwing their Jack Daniels bottles out on our
street. Yeah, but they. They weren't as refined a crowd as they thought they were they? But it was a big event. Now they have it up in Cartersville or somewhere like that, but it was right out in this farm here that's no longer a farm anymore, I guess, the development. So, but we were excited about that, all those things, and the future of polo. One thing led to another, though, and I got promoted and got transferred to Michigan the next year. So all that effort and plans we had fell apart and we were excited about that. Of course, it was a great opportunity, and we were both from Ohio, so we weren't too nervous about going back up north. You know, we just joined polo, and I went to Butch Hansen, who was a pro. I said, Butch, you know, what do we do here? There's no rules. There certainly weren't any out-of-state members. I mean, nobody was trying to get a membership of polo outside of Forsyth County. So he cut me a deal, as Butch would do, and I paid $25 a month for out-of-state membership. And which wasn't that big of a bargain, but it was, you know, really club memberships were more expensive back then than they are now in real money. But I wanted to keep it for business reasons to come down here and play. Also, my wife, her mother and sister had moved down here, and I knew we'd be coming down here to visit. So we moved to Michigan and kind of pressed the reset button and as far as who we were and what we were about. And we left our friends behind and had a chance to just be with each other. And we joined a small church up in Whitmore Lake, Michigan, as Hines said. And my office was in Farmington Hills, which is a suburb of Michigan. And we decided to start a family. And one thing about living in the North, it's pretty conducive to starting a family, if you know what I mean. Those are cold winters. So we ended up having three daughters. All three of my daughters were born in Michigan. And got really involved in our church, and this is a small church, and any of you that's been to a small church, you have to be involved in a small church because that's how it works. So that was good for us, and there were several small young couples as well, and we got to have a nice community. And probably the biggest influence on me, an issue when I was there, is there was a 3-day men's retreat that we did. And it's not Emmaus. It was, you've probably heard of Promise Keepers. I don't know if you've watched ESPN recently, but they do a 30 for 30 on Bill McCartney, who is the coach, former coach of Colorado University Buffaloes, and he was a founder of the Promise Keepers. I haven't watched it. I've went back and forth on that 30 for 30. I don't know how much they get into the Promise Keepers, but quite a story about him anyway. And the Promise Keepers was a men's retreat where first time I'd ever been to a men's retreat, number one, where they emphasize men taking control of their family and being the head of the household, which seems like a pretty good concept, doesn't it? Whether you're spiritual or not, the man should run the household. But they got some pushback on the feminists by that, said, you know, that's not the way it should be. Well, we think that's the way it should be, don't we? I mean, we're all men here and run it. So, but I wasn't that cognizant of that, and it really took hold of me and said, you know what, I've got three daughters. They need a man that takes control of the family and is a spiritual leader. And that I came away from that really energized in being a good dad and a good husband. So you say, well, that's Michigan. Everything's going good. What are you doing here? I mean, it sounds like you had a good life. Well, we did have a great life, and it's so good that I got recruited for a big job at a bank in Southfield, Michigan. Everything you want, more money, more 17th floor, corner office, company car, and just blew me away with the executive dining room. You get eat for free on the company. That it was a new concept for me and certainly enticing. So my wife and I looked at each other and said, you know, what's to talk about? I mean, this is a great opportunity. You know, we can set ourselves up. So, you know, it wasn't exactly what I wanted, but it made sense. So I took the job. I had interviewed with the president of the bank and the chairman of the bank, and within 2 months, both those guys left to start their own bank. So I thought, I'll make this work with the ownership, which was a family-owned bank, but it didn't. Within 6 months, I was out of work, and we call that a Joseph calling, you know, where Joseph is walking around with his nice coat in the Bible, and the next thing you know, he's in the pit, his brothers are selling him for a slave. You wonder, and he trying to make sense out of that adversity when I'm driving home saying, you know, I'm out of a job. Sure, they gave me a little severance, but it doesn't matter how big your severance is. That doesn't pay for your kids' education and their college. And, you know, when you're driving home, you're thinking about the weddings and how am I going to do all this? And of course, I was embarrassed that it happened. And so I got home and waited for the kids to go to bed. They were too small to know it, but I still waited, and I told my wife, I'm out of a job. And we looked at each other and said, how in the heck did we get here? Everything was good. And I thought, wait, I'm the head of the household. I made this, you know, I should have been making this decision. And what I forgot was a small part of that is you need to include God in your decision when you make big or little decisions. And we hadn't done that as a couple. We had made that on our own. And not that God probably wasn't nudging me, saying, you know, you better think about this. I did not listen to that. So we immediately said, we have to own up to that and confess that we didn't do that. And so we did that. And a lot of times us guys will, when we have this adversity, will, you know, batten down the hatches. You know, we'll handle this. Let me do it. Don't tell anybody that you're hurting, whether it's a job, a sickness, or whatever. And, you know, I didn't do that, or we didn't as a couple. We told our neighbors that, you know, I was out of job, and that we'd screwed up. And because they had seen me driving the company car around, you know, acting like a big shot. So when that guy was gone, they knew something anyway. But it humbled me. But I wanted to, I got up in our church and said, you know, we had made a mistake. We had not tried to follow God. And that was a great time in my life to get to know my kids a little bit, drive them to preschool, and talk a little bit to our neighbors and this and that, and while I'm networking with folks, let them know what I had done, so it wasn't all bad, but nothing happened though when we put all this out and everybody prayed for us. I didn't get a job the next day, and didn't get it the next month, didn't get it the next 2 months, 3 months. But after 6 months, I had a job offer, two of them, one in Detroit and one here. And I wanted to jump right on this one because we, you know, my wife had family. But we really said, is this God? Is this what you want us to do? You know, we had made trips down here, like I said, to see my wife's family here, and we had seen Polo grow, and we'd actually went through the Street of Dreams here on Oakbrook Way, and went through those houses and said, well, these are nice, we'll never be able to afford these houses, but it's something to dream about. Matter of fact, one house had in the master bedroom, had a wet bar and a little college boy refrigerator. And I said, why would anybody need that in their master bedroom? When we had the opportunity to take this job in Atlanta, and it worked out, we were able to move here to Polo, rejoin Coming First United Methodist Church, and guess what I have in my bedroom now? Don't use it, but I have that. We bought that house with the wet bar, one of the great things. Also for our kids was they were just the age that my oldest started first grade at Vickery, a brand new school, when we came back in 98. And they've went through the whole Vickery thing. When they got old enough, Vickery Middle was built. And then two of them went to South, but the youngest, when she was a freshman at West. So, I mean, what a great blessing it was for us to move here, and we knew that when we came here, and we were fired up to give all the glory to God. And so when we rejoined Coming First United Methodist Church, I mean, we didn't know very many people the first half. They got a couple that said, we're ready to connect, and my wife was a stay-at-home mom, and she volunteered, and we both took a disciple class. How are we doing on time? What's my time here? I don't want to. I've got plenty of stories, and I only want to tell a few.
Well, you can talk as long as you want, but we'll leave at 9:30.
Okay. Well, I'll save the best ones for after 9:30. I can just entertain myself. I won't take too long. But we really got connected in the Coming First United Methodist Church, and you know, there's a couple guys here that go to Coming First, and there's plenty of opportunity, and there is at all churches. And the two things that both of us did together was, one, we took a disciple class, which is a Bible study, and it's a 32-week course that you go from Genesis to Revelation with a group of people. And it really, for the first time, I'd gotten a base of what's in the Bible. I mean, I knew the verses, knew stories, and that was great. And they talk about your talents when you finish up that class. So what are you going to do? You know, one of the people said, you know, Jim, you're a good speaker. You know, your voice is... it just resonates. And I said, in other words, I got a big mouth, is what you're saying. And she said, yeah, okay. Because of that, one of the educational people asked me to give my testimony about the Disciple One class, just a 5-minute talk in front of the congregation. And so I did that. I didn't want to do that. I didn't think I was a speaker, and I'm not sure that I am still. And you guys are kind of nodding your head, yeah, you're not really a speaker, Jim. And I get that, but, you know, I got to answer that call when somebody says, like, Heinz, talk. So I answered that call, did a five-minute talk about disciple class and how it was just what I said. It gave me a great base, and nothing. I mean, you know, it's not like the congregation did me a standing ovation or anything. They just, okay, go sit down but the next day, our minister, assistant minister, sent me an email. This is 98. Said, hey, we got a picture of a new minister on our website. And it was a picture of me standing there doing the, just like this. And she was making a joke, of course. Rebecca is who it was for you guys. She did that. And so I like a good joke on myself. So I took that. And this is, again, 98. The websites were kind of new, certainly for me, and certainly for churches, but I figured out how to copy the address and emailed it to a few people at work and a few friends of mine in Michigan and Ohio and around here, and said, hey, you know, I've taken up a part-time job as a minister at Coming First United Methodist Church. Yeah, it's funny. And that was it, but about 2 days later, a gal works for me said, Jim, she says, I really like your talk on disciple. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, if you click on your picture, you can hear your talk. And I said, then I was embarrassed because I didn't know that's how that worked, didn't know anything about it. But the thing about it was, you know, talk about my talent, it was I didn't have that great a talent, but God took that and used it to how he wanted to, and several people in my office took disciple class or made aware of it, friends here and there, and just like today, you know, I don't know where this is going. It's not an exciting talk, but there might be something that God will use for someone in here, and maybe none of you. Maybe the tape that I'm speaking to right now, maybe that hits somebody and hits a nerve somewhere. So that was, you know, the disciple class and the subsequent testimony, and I can't quit without the one other thing I did, because these guys are here, was going on the Emmaus walk, which is a three-day a time of reflection, and it's really hard to explain, but it's an outstanding way to get in touch with as men and women with really the ideas become a leader in your church. And that's what it was perfect for us at the time in 98, where we were wanting to pay back all the blessings we did. And two things came out of that that weekend was, you know, I've talked about being a leader in the church and being involved, and I have gotten involved with some of our ministries, and Tom and both Toms over there. We have a intercessory prayer ministry at our church where we keep track of you know, people's prayers, and we pray for them, and I write notes to them each week, two people each week, and you know, we do that in our household on Sunday nights when my kids were growing up. We had a prayer list where we prayed for whoever, their friends or relatives or whoever, our leadership, our country, and our you know, military, etc. The other thing was the Walk to Emmaus emphasizes that you get together with a men's accountability group, guys. I can't tell you enough. These guys here are. I have a separate accountability group that I meet with on Friday mornings, but we meet on Thursday nights, and we have an accountability group as well temporarily. And that is so important for men to find. I find guys that are much smarter than me and much more accomplished, like these two guys, and they lift me up, and I've been doing that since 98 on Friday mornings at Starbucks with four other guys, and you know, it helps to be able to say, hey, I screwed up this week, and whatever screw up I do, because I do a lot of them, and you know, guys can tell you, you know, how to extricate yourself from that screw up, but again, men have so much wanting to do with themselves, and it's no fun to go through life like that. You know, it's much easier if you can have a few guys with it. So that the Walk to Emmaus was huge with that. the corporate prayer piece was in that, you know, I do at our church and my family. And I like to tell a story about corporate prayer because we were talking about the flooding here at Polo. And before that, though, we had a drought. And remember, Governor Perdue said, when we had a drought for like a year or 2 years, I mean, Lake Lanier was empty practically, and he said, we need to pray for a rain. And he took some heat for that, didn't he? He said, what, that's your plan, Governor Perdue, to pray? And next thing you know, a month later, it got a little rain, and then we got this flood out here at Polo, and I think we had a 100-year flood, and then he has another news conference, and what'd he say? Whoever's still praying, would you please stop? So, anyway, guys, I'll wrap this up. I want to tell you about my mother. She passed away last year at 91, and great life. I mean, and a great woman, and she was sharp as a tack right up until the end. She had a little heart problem that we couldn't get fixed, and so we celebrated. But I'm sure the age group here, most of you have lost a parent. Some of you guys, hopefully your parents are still alive. But no matter how much you expect it, it's still tough to lose a parent. I mean, it just is tough. And it's a life changer for you. And for me, I didn't do very well with the mourning process. We celebrate her life at the funeral, but afterwards, it became inward, and I'm feeling sorry for Jim, and the next thing you know, I'm depressed a little bit, and I'm starting to think and do things to gratify me instead of the other way of serving others. And I was in that funk for 6 months. I didn't even know it. I was even doing it, and really, my friends, it was just an inner thing that I was sitting there worrying about myself and trying to, there was some behavior. I maybe overserved myself, drinking a little bit more than what I had in the past, and some other things that I'm not proud of. But I got together with a group of guys like this after a tough weekend and said, you know, I just don't like who I am. And this was in February. And we prayed about it and something came over me, and I just kind of reinvigorated myself, and things have been changing for me. I mean, this is my second talk in 2 months, and like I said, I never do this. I'm talking next month as part of Emmaus Walk. I haven't taken a drink since February, and not that, you know, I just haven't. My life is in such a great place. But I'm just saying, you can go from a bad place and have that Joseph calling and get in a good place. But no matter how good things are, you can have that bad place hit you, and when you least expect it. So again, I encourage you to make sure you have some friends that can be accountable, because that can happen at any time. So I appreciate the time to talk to you guys. I really know that Saturdays are valuable to all of us. And anybody have any other questions they'd like to ask me or anything like that? Yes, sir.
It's great, great talk, and I appreciate it. This is totally off the subject, except in your bio. I think in your bio is something about Fifth Third Bank, and I'll probably Google this. I've always wondered, how in the world did they come up with that?
You know, I was at Fifth Third for really a short time. For a number of reasons, but that is the number one question I would get. And when they started the bank in Cincinnati, is where it's from, they were on the corner of 5th Street and 3rd Avenue, and it was 5th Third Bank. So, and May 3rd, which is 5-3, they have a big celebration every year. And that's their logo, 5-3, that's their website. Yes, Tom. Well, that's, you know, we didn't call it the Ohio State University when I was there. I don't know where the Ohio State came from. It's kind of I don't know if I agree with it or not, but now it is what it is. Yeah, I don't know why they did it, but it's kind of arrogant, but that's football players, I guess. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jim. I've heard this is the second time, and I remember the end of his talk was very meaningful to me because there's some things going on in my kids' families and stuff that are really kind of troubling, and we have great kids. They love the Lord. But when something happens to your immediate family, you kind of take that on yourself. And I had kind of gone into that grieving kind of thing that Jim had mentioned about his mom, and the importance of corporate prayer really resonated with me. And I did like Jim and kind of shared how that heaviness was on me. And I think that's a good takeaway in general. I think as men, we like to be the lone strangers and, you know, kind of tough it out. But that can lead us into some really dead ends. So anyway, that was one takeaway I had. The other thing in kind of conjunction with the Olympics is somebody shared this the other day, but it's really true. We're in a relay race of people that have gone before us that have created an environment that allowed us to do certain things, and now we've got the baton on their shoulders to move forward. And somebody said one time about the current situation in the world, which is kind of unsettling, although, you know, in my life there have been, you know, Cuban missile crisis and all kind of things that have happened that were unsettling. But somebody said, you know, all this stuff that's happening, it's on our watch. We don't have anybody else to blame. So the importance of recognizing the responsibility we have to honor those that have gone before us, whether it's our mother and father, whether it's people that have been key to us in our church or wherever, but also to move the baton forward with the younger people. And that's a hard thing to do. It's harder today, I think, to connect and intermingle with younger people than ever before, because some of us more mature people, I don't like the word old, but we're not quite as comfortable with the technology, which is just normal for the youth of today. So the challenge is how can you help to engage with the youth in your life or families and really pass on things that you've learned, which, you know, I hear a lot of testimonies, and often I'll hear people say, well, I don't have really that big of a story. Well, you do. And it needs to be shared with other people. And many of you have talked at the breakfast, and those of you who haven't yet will, if I can help it. But anyway, I'm just kidding. Don't get nervous. But good message, and to try to encourage us in trying to transfer what we've learned maybe to some of the younger people in our lives. So thank you for coming, and have your cup of coffee. We'll see you in, I think, November is the next one. So appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks, Jim.